I don't know if this thing's tall enough, but I hope it is. My name is Joe Robinson, and I'm an alcoholic. And I am really glad to be here. You should see the way y'all faces look, all those little smiles out there. I kind of like that. Because you're going to see me smile a lot up here. And I got that from Alcoholics Anonymous. I really did. My sobriety date is June 18th, 1996. My home group is the Blue Sky Weekday Group of Alcoholics Anonymous back in Philadelphia on 8th and Spruce Street. I'm 57 years old, and I'm probably the youngest one in my home group. So I'm bragging about my home group. It's some really good sobriety there. If you're ever in Philadelphia on a Tuesday or a Thursday, stop in. You know, we would love to have you. My sponsor is Steve Otto. As a matter of fact, he's our Area 59 delegate in Philadelphia. I was told to get in service in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got a service sponsor. And I'm in awe to be here. I want to thank who's ever responsible for having me here this evening. I want to thank the Southern California Speakers Group for having me. I'm really honored. I'm really grateful. Really honored. I'm nervous. I'm glad that I'm nervous, because when I stand up here in front of a bunch of people and I'm not nervous, that's when I'm going to really worry. Believe me. You know, I like to try to start off with a little bit of fun, you know, because I'm thinking right now, if you can't have fun in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're in the wrong room. I mean, just told me how to laugh. Now, I know what y'all thinking out there. You know, look at this tall, dark, and handsome guy up here. You know. See, I like to get that laugh just to see who's paying attention. You know, so it seems like you are. So since you're paying attention, let me say this. If you're new, and you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, give yourself a chance and stay with us and watch what we do. Please, to my old-timers, who I have a place in my heart for always, thank you. Thank you so much. And please don't confuse my quivering voice or my crying for weakness. Thank you for keeping these doors open so that when I got here, there was a here. Now that we got that out of the way, I need to say this. I don't eat fried chicken. I don't eat watermelon either. I don't play basketball. And I don't dance. But what I did do, was I drank. You know, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is real clear about what we're supposed to do. You know, and that's to tell you in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. You know, and sometimes I hear like, oh, I don't want to hear this drunk log, and I don't want to hear all that. Well, what do you want to hear? What do you want to hear? Oh, I want to hear the solution. Okay. Well, we'll get to that, but doesn't it say in a general way to let you guys know what it was like? And what it was like for this alcoholic was, I grew up in North Philadelphia. You know, I come from a family, there was five children, and I was the oldest one. Four boys and one girl. You know, and from ever since I can remember, my dad always told me that I knew better. You know, so he was already probing in me. No one could ever tell me anything because my dad already said that I knew better and I already had all the answers. So my head was already starting to get hard. You know, my parents was like gypsies. They moved around. We never owned our own home or anything like that. You know, and I don't know about anybody else in here, but it seems like your parents' room is the biggest room in the house. So for little kids, it could be like Wonderland. And for me, that's what it was. And I remember one day wandering in Wonderland, you know, and wandering in my parents' closet. And there was three things I found in that closet that I did not know would be with me for most of my life. And what was in that closet was a bunch of bottles. One of them was green with a yellow label with the two big red letters on it. The other one was brown. It was square. It had fruit on the bottom of it. And the other one was white with a yellow background with orange writing. And if you drank like I drank, you know that that's J&B, Rock and Rye, and Gordon's Gin. You know, now, at that age, I wasn't an alcoholic then. I mean, I wasn't like with the J&B or whatever. That wasn't me. What I did was the Rock and Rye interests me. And I don't know, maybe it's a kid thing, you know. It was the stuff on the bottom, you know. I like candy or whatever. So I remember screwing the top off, and I remember sticking my fingers in it and tasting it. And it tasted sweet and it tasted good. I didn't black out or none of that stuff. And nothing else ever happened from that. The other things that was in that closet was my father used to save a lot of his change and stuff. You know, and that would come in handy later on in life for me. You know, and another thing that he had in that closet, and I don't know why, I guess my parents was experimenting or keeping their love young, was a lot of, I called them girly books back then. But those are the three things that in my life I would come to do. You know, I would come to always rob and steal and have money. I would become an alcoholic, you know, and I would become this, whatever you want to call it. I thought I was some kind of sex god, but that wasn't happening for real. You know, and then as my life went on, you know, my parents moved from here to there because, as I said, you know, we were like gypsies and we didn't own our own home, you know. And I remember there was a time in my life when my grandfather had passed away and my mother sent me to live with my grandmother. So I lived with my grandmother for some time. And the only time I seen, like, alcohol and alcohol at its worst was, like, one of my aunts. I guess one night she tied it on a whole lot, and she came in, and she was throwing up and stuff like that. And I was kind of scared, you know. I was about maybe 8 or 9, something like that, when that was going on in my life. I didn't like being away from my brothers and sisters. And I begged my grandmother to let me go back and live with my mom and them. And when I did, our house caught on fire. We moved to a neighborhood in Philadelphia called the Spring Garden section. And around that time, I was about 10 or 11, something like that. And I remember I had joined a gang. Now, I didn't know what gangs was about. And if you ever been from a gang, you know that all they do is drink and fight. You know, and so, and that's what, that was my life. Now, and I'm giving you this, like, in a general way, you know. I mean, I can, there was other things that happened in my life. Like when I was like 7 years old, I begged my mom if I can go out and play when we moved to 9th and Huntington in Philadelphia. My mother said no. You know why my mother said no? Because y'all have that maternal instinct that you're not ready for your children to run out there down the block and mess around, you know. And if you're alcoholic like me, I'm going to pull at your heartstrings. I'm going to pull them right out of your chest. And I'm going to keep on begging and begging you. And I remember begging and begging my mom to let me go out. And she finally broke down and said, yeah, but take your brothers and your sister with you. And when you do, I want you to sit on the steps. And for some reason, I don't know why, but I sat on the bottom step. And my feet was in that motion like I'm ready to move. And what seemed like for a long time, my mother stood in the doorway because I think she was more worried about her children, you know. And she finally went in. And as soon as she went in, I got up off those steps and I went down the street. And I can tell you this to the day. When I went down the street, I don't know what happened to me. All I know is I got lost. I met some people and I just got lost. My parents taught me and my brothers and my sisters values and morals. When I went down the street and I picked up that first Budweiser, all those values and all those morals went out the window. I picked up my own, I created my own values and morals. And when we finally moved to down the Spring Garden section, I was already rearing and ready to go. You know, I met up with these two guys. And I wind up joining a gang, and that was my life, drinking and fighting. On 11th and Spring Garden in Philadelphia, there's a steak store. And I used to be on that corner at 8 in the morning. And my father would be going to work. And he would walk by me, and he would be shaking his head. And at 5:30 to 6 o'clock, I would be on that same corner when he got off of work. And my attitude to him was like, what are you looking at? You know, this is what I'm doing. And that's all I ever wanted to do, was drink. Because once I put that booze in me, it changed my life forever. You know, nobody, I wasn't going to be the, as you guys can see, I'm very animated. You know, I wasn't going to be the shy guy or none of that stuff. Booze did everything for me. I love when people are like, oh, booze destroyed my life and they did this and they did that. Not for me. I had fun with booze. It taught me everything, gave me everything. You know, I had the girls, I had the money, I had everything with booze. But like booze, it turned on me at some point, you know. And what happened was, you know, I got crazy out there. That's my life in the general way, you know. Gang war, drinking, and what happens with a lot of that stuff is you start getting arrested. So as a juvenile, I was arrested 16 times. My mother, she might have came and got me out 3 times, and then she just stopped. As an adult, I was arrested 21 times with 7 felony convictions. Now, I never blamed any of that on alcohol. You know why? Because when I went to jail, I was so good with the booze, I started making booze in prison. You know, and that's what you do. I mean, you know, you go to prison, you make booze, you play pinochle, and that's it. And you lift weights, you get big. You know, and you come out and you take one of these girls hostage. You know, because I don't know, for some reason, every time I went to prison and came out, I don't know what the attraction is. You know, like, why would you want a criminal? But I was all for it, you know. And I take you hostage, and I move into your house with your kids, you know, and I tell you I love you and all that, and I didn't love you at all. I mean, one of the things I love about Alcoholics Anonymous, this is an honest program. I got a daughter out there who I pushed aside. So don't tell me I loved you. I didn't love you one bit. I loved me, and that's all I ever did. Ever since I picked up alcohol was love me. They said, well, what about your poor old mom? What about her? What about your poor old dad? What about her? You know, if you can't get me booze, if you can't get me what I want, I have no reason for you. None whatsoever. You know, and that is the way I lived out there. That is the way I lived on the street, you know. And I didn't care about anybody or anything. And it's a sad way to live, but that was it, you know. What I used to do when the steak store closed in Philadelphia, they got a thing called Skid Row. And I used to go down Skid Row. And if you're older in here, you may know about Tokay and stuff like that. You know, and those old guys used to have that Tokay and stuff down there. You know, and I used to drink with them, you know. But see, like our book say, Jekyll and Hyde. Once I turned into Hyde, that was it. You know, I would rob these bums. And that's what I called them, bums. Today I know they were just hopeless alcoholics. But you know what? I would rob them. I would take whatever little they had. I didn't care a thing about them. You know? And that's the way I lived. And that's the way it was for me, you know? It came to a head for me, you know, because I like the part about what happened. You know, it came to a head when the girl who I had took hostage, I had just stolen all her money that weekend, you know, from her and her kids. And I asked her to get me a half a gallon of Wild Irish Rose, you know, and she said, I'll think about it. But she got it, you know, she got it. And as we were sitting there eating dinner, she was pulling glasses and glasses of Wild Irish Rose, and I was drinking them down like this, and I was blaming her for my plot in life. I'm this way because of you, you know, and I picked a fight with her. And I got out of there. And what I wanted was more alcohol. And when you want more alcohol, you need money. And when you don't have a job and you do crime like I did, you're breaking stuff. You know, and I tried to break into the little store that I was working in, and I wind up in the guy's house. And my sponsor years ago told me to always share this because it helps me. It helps me a lot. It shows just how far alcohol can take you, you know. And I broke into this guy's house, and all I wanted was a little bit of money. And this guy said he didn't have any money. And this guy was about 70 years old. But when you try to tell a nasty, raging alcoholic, you know, that you ain't got something that they want, especially a violent alcoholic, I don't want to hear it. And what I saw was an 18-inch knife over on his table, and I picked it up and I stabbed him 6 times. And I have to tell you right now, when I did that, I did not care. I did not care one bit. You know, what I did care for was trying to get out of there when I heard the sirens coming. You know, and I hid in a closet because that's what I used to say, that's what cowards do, you know what I mean? We go and we hide, you know, and I hid in a closet, you know, and they found me. And when they brought me through that guy's house, there was blood everywhere, all over the walls and all this stuff, you know, and I didn't know if he was dead or alive. I really didn't care. And they hauled me off to prison. And when I was in there, they told me, you're in here for aggravated assault. I didn't know whether the guy died or not, you know, and I didn't care. And they hauled me off to jail. And when I went in front of the judge, he sentenced me to 6 to 12 years upstate. You know, and I remember when he said, I sentence you to 6 to 12 years. I don't know if you could see me up here. My leg started shaking. And we talk about it in Alcoholics Anonymous all the time. It was nothing but unadulterated fear. You know, and that's what kept me out there all that time. Fear. Afraid of everything. You know, and I told the judge, he said, you got anything to say? I said, yeah, I don't ever want to do anything like this again. He said, good. And he sent me upstate. And I love, like, when rehabs and all that stuff come into our meetings, you know, because I did the rehab thing over and over and over again. And what I used to think about rehab and stuff like that, I used to think the counselors were idiots. I'm here to tell you, they're not idiots. Some people generally want to help you, you know. And I got upstate and I got into every self-help movement thing they had in there so that I could change my life. And what I did was I accumulated a folder this thick full of achievements. And at 5.5 years in prison, they said, Joe Robinson, you've been a good boy. We're going to send you home on furlough so that you can see your mother and your father and your family. And when they let me out that gate, the bus stopped in Harrisburg, and the bus driver said, we will be a half an hour before we go on to Philadelphia. And something in my head said, not me. I'm going in town. And I went in town, and I went in the liquor store, and I bought a pint of Tanqueray. Now, let me tell you why I bought a pint of Tanqueray. Because when I was in prison, Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg had this song out called Gin and Juice. And every time we seen the videos, they were partying. And I felt like I missed my turn. I didn't care about the guy that I stabbed almost to death. I didn't care about being in prison 5.5 years. I didn't care about none of that stuff. You know, I got drunk. I got home. When I got to Philly and I walked through my parents' door, hey, and the look on their face, because here come your 38-year-old baby, because that's what came through the door, a 38-year-old baby. I didn't learn nothing. When I was upstate, what I did was I talked the talk. See, when you go in and out of rehabs and you go in and out of prison, one of the things you can learn really good is the gift of gab. You know, it's talking the talk, not walking the walk. See, I didn't know how to walk any walk because I wasn't listening to anybody. You know, there was a point in my life where I thought I was a counselor for this program. You know what I mean? I had my own group, which was D group. I had guys doing Gestalt therapy and all this stuff. So how am I going to come in here and let you guys tell me what's up? You don't know. I look at you, you're just a bunch of drunks yourselves. You know, and that's how I always looked at stuff. I never listened to anybody. Like I said in the beginning, my father told me I knew better. I know better. I don't know what it is I was supposed to know, but I knew better. You know, so when I went back to prison, they said, Joe, didn't you read on the sheet where we told you you're not allowed to drink? You're not allowed to do anything? And they put my butt in the hole where I should have been, where they should have put me. See, because what I was going to do, I was going to get out of prison. I was going to come out here and I was going to hurt somebody. You know, I was going to kill somebody. You know, because that's where alcohol was taking me, you know. They say, oh, it wasn't the alcohol. Oh, yes, it was. Yes, it was. How come I'm not out there killing anybody now? See, let me pick up that drink, and I might think about killing you, you know. So what happened was I went in front of this board, and what they did was they gave me 2 weeks in the hole, you know. And it don't get no lower than that. You're already upstate, you know. And here's the things that, like, this alcoholic didn't think about. I'm upstate. And why I'm upstate, what's happening is my family members are out there dying. And I can't see them. I can't go to their funerals or anything like that. You know, because I'm a 38, 39-year-old baby who don't know how to behave itself, who don't know how to act, you know. They put me in a hole for 2 weeks. And I don't know what it was. I was there. I thought about my mom. I thought about my father for the first time in my life. And I thought about what it must be like for them to have to explain to my aunts and my uncles how come their grown son isn't coming home. And it did make me feel sick, you know. And I remember getting on my knees, you know. And the only thing I said on my knees was, dear God, please help me. You know, I love it. I love the feelings. And that was all I said was, God, help me, please. Because I didn't know what to do, you know. And when my 2 weeks in the hole was up and I got out, there was 2,300 inmates up at Rockview State Prison. And most of them was pointing their fingers at me saying, I knew he was full of it. I knew he was full of it. I knew he was full of it. And for the first time in my life, I knew they were right, and I didn't put my head down. Because they were right. All I knew how to do was talk the talk. I didn't know how to walk the walk. See, I went through this whole thing, like with the Bible and all this stuff, where, let me tell you something, I could quote verses, and I could do this, and and all that stuff, you know. I could quote the big book so good, you would think I was Bill Wilson, the illegitimate son. But that's not going to keep me sober, you know. That just comes from reading and remembering things, you know what I mean? I can use that, you know, and go on a whole, you know, deal, man. You know, I love our books. I love our literature. Don't get me wrong now. If you're a big book thumper, let me say this to you. Thank you. Thank you. You know, that's our literature. And we need to be reading it. And we need to be remembering it, you know, so we can learn how to live, you know. And like, so what happened was they let me out of the hole, and they got me back on this block called the DNA program up there. And I went in front of the parole board after 9 months, and they wouldn't let me go home. And they sent me my green sheet, and it said, you're a chronic alcoholic. And that's exactly what it said on there. You're a chronic alcoholic, you know. And they gave me a year hit. So I did good for a whole year. I went in front of the parole board again, and they gave me another year hit. And on this green sheet, it said, you're a habitual alcoholic. So I was like, oh, my God. Where are they getting these words from? You know? You know, here's the point I want you to think about. Here's what I want you to think about, because I think about this all the time. You know, and it saddens me. It really do, because I spent $3.69 for a pint of alcohol that and jeopardized 2 more years of my life. And in those 2 years, that grandmother that I lived with died, and I was not able to go to her funeral. My uncle died, and I was not able to go to that funeral. $3.69. 2 years of my life. Alcohol was still winning. You know, it pains me. It just pains me. It hurts. You know, so they finally let me out of prison. And when they did, they sent me to a place called York, Pennsylvania, you know. First, I wanted to go back to Philadelphia, but Philadelphia turned me down. And to be honest with you, I don't blame them, you know. I wouldn't want somebody like me in my neighborhood, you know. So they turned me down. And then York turned me down, then Philly turned me down, then York gave me a chance again. And I'll never forget this woman. She told me, she said, Joe, when you get out, what I want you to do is you go to Alcoholics Anonymous and you put your hand up and you tell those people you need help. And I got to tell you guys, you know, for the first time in my life, when I got out of prison, I was 40 years old. You know, when I went in, I was 32. When I got out, I was 40. And I remember I got out and I weighed 220 pounds, solid muscle, you know. I come out like this and everything. I walked into that Alcoholics Anonymous meeting on Broad Street in York, Pennsylvania, and this was my hand. This was my hand. And I remember somebody called on me and they said, yes, and I said, my name's Joe, in a quivering voice, like it is now. But this is good stuff, so don't get it confused. You know, I'm remembering the time. So don't get it confused. The hand went up, and I said, could you help me? And you guys, you said you would. And you told me to keep coming back, because you know how y'all love those slogans, you know. And I kept coming back, you know. And, oh my God, you know, my wife talked about it, you know. My life, just for that one day, started changing, you know. And I remember I heard this guy, he was in the meeting on Broad Street, you know, and he don't care if I drop his name because he was my first sponsor. His name was Peter Lucas. And I remember he was sharing, and he said, listen, if anyone wants to go with me after this meeting, I'm going to Maryland. Anybody want to go, you're welcome to go. And I don't know what it is, but I wanted to go. I wanted to go with that guy, and I came up and I asked him, I said, can I go to Maryland with you to another meeting? And he said, sure. And then I asked that man to be my sponsor, and you know what he told me? He said he'd be honored. He said he'd be honored. Wow. I'm the oldest in my family. I have my dad. I don't have big brothers. I'm the big brother. I never remember anybody ever talking to me like that, saying that they would be honored to have me or to help me. You know, and that was special. You know, and Pete asked me, first thing out of his mouth, are you willing to go to any lengths? And the first thing I said was, yeah. Because that's what we always say, yeah. Now, mind you, I've done 7.5 years in prison. I am not waiting a year. I'm sorry. That's just my deal, you know. And I hooked up with some girl, man. I wasn't waiting. And he and you know what Pete told me? He said, Joe, you got emotions. He told me to be careful. Well, you see, I'm bald, right? So I don't have no hair. I didn't drink, though, at least, you know. But Pete got me right into the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I love the way they say it. The way they say it. Here are the steps which are suggested as a program of recovery. Yeah, they're just suggested. Well, I'm here to tell you, if you want to change the insides, I suggest you do them. You know, I'm not a preacher. I'm just saying what happened to me. I've done the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went from a bum on the street, okay, with a vent that has my name on it, to what's standing in front of you today. You know, and I know that that's through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's what's changed me inside. They changed my whole life, you know. I didn't have to think that I was powerless over alcohol. I know I'm powerless over alcohol. Nobody gets 16 arrested as a juvenile, 21 as an adult, in and out of prison, in and out of rehabs. Every time I put alcohol in my body, I'm screwed up, you know? And of course, my life is unmanageable. You know who manages my life today? My beautiful wife. Y'all heard up here. And I don't have a problem with that. I don't have a problem with that, you know. I say, I'm going to be flashy. Listen, I couldn't manage anything out there. Look, I got money in my pocket because she makes sure that I have a couple bucks. You know what I mean? And that's all right. That's all right for me today. You know? What was hard for me was that second step, you know. And my wife actually talked a little bit about it. Well, I had this thing. When I was with my grandmother, she drugged me to church 4 times a week. And let me tell you something. I hated it. United Methodist Church. I hated it. I did not understand it, you know. And I didn't want to know parts of it. So when I moved back home, for some reason, I became a Muslim. In Philadelphia on Broad Street, I was selling Muhammad Speets and bean pies. I was sitting at my parents' table with a gray suit on and a red bow tie. And my father said to me one day, he said, are you a first-class jackass? And I don't know. I guess I was. Because, I mean, I'm a Muslim. I'm a man about God. But yet I'm out robbing people. What is that about? You know, I go in rehab and they put me in this group called A Group, and that's with a Christian overtone, and we're watching Tammy Faye and Jim Baker, and I'm like, what is going on? I got the Bible in my hand. Remember I told you I memorized the Bible? Yeah, this is why. You know, so we got this thing going on. We're having prayer meetings on Wednesday, so I'm talking in tongues now. You know, I mean, I don't know. I know it came to a head on 9th and Chestnut in Philadelphia when I was down and out. I was hustling for a quarter Thunderbird, you know, and this person said, hey, would you like to chant the Buddha? And I said, can I get $2? And they said, yeah, if you come upstairs and chant the Buddha. So I found myself on the 9th floor of the Ben Franklin Hotel chanting, and I don't mean no disrespect to some little fat guy, you know. But all I was worried about was, you know, the $2, because I need to drink. I'll tell you something, though. I chanted the Buddha, and they said, chant for whatever you want. And I chanted for money, of course. 2 weeks later, I was in the union.
Oh, wow.
That's what I said. More money to drink. You know, and that's what happened. I just drank more. That's all. I got more money, and I drank more. You know? But my sponsor, you know, they talk about soundness of mind, you know, in that second step and stuff like that. And, you know, for me, it's really simple, being restored to sanity. And I used to say it like this. I used to say, you know what? I remember when I was little, my mother used to make the dinner table and stuff. And I just had dinner with my friends, John and Colleen. And they made the dinner table with knife, spoon, fork, napkin, ice water, you know what I mean? The butter dish and stuff like that. And I remember those times when my mother used to do that. And my wife does that, you know what I mean, today. And so I'm a little bit of sanity, a little bit of soundness of mind, a little bit of when I lay my head down on the pillow tonight, you know, it's not racing. It's not racing anymore. You know, and the third step for me was just simple. You know what I mean? You just get on your knees, say your third step prayer, because that's what I make all my sponsees do. They do it on my second floor, on our second floor front. And they do it right before they get ready to embark on that action, because they're going to do their fourth step and they're going to do their fifth step with me. They're not doing it with no, you're not getting in the cab and giving a guy no money and telling him your stuff. And a lot of times when those guys get to me, they're not all that religious. So they're not going to no priest. I want to know your 12 steps, because when you get to acting goofy in these rooms, I'm going to pull you up. See, I gave all my stuff to my sponsor, Pete, you know, because I can be a goofball at times, you know. I like to get in here and act all goofy, you know, and that just wasn't happening. And Pete wasn't having that, you know. And when it came to my defects, you know what I mean, it's simple. They say remove all of them, not some of them. So just remove them all, you know. No one's perfect. I'm not perfect. You know, I'm going to make a lot of mistakes and stuff like that. But then I'm going to continue to pray for the willingness to keep on being a better human being and to keep on working on these things. And that's what I do, you know. And I want to talk about amends because I don't have a lot of time. When I was in that courtroom, for the longest I used to say I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous because I want to be, you know. When I was in that courtroom, the judge asked me, he said, do you want to say anything? And I said, yes, Your Honor, I do. And I turned around, and the man who I stabbed 6 times was sitting in the courtroom. And I told that gentleman that I was sorry, that I had no right to come in his life and do the things that I did. And I'll never forget what that man said to me, because it always gets me today. He says, son, I forgive you. You know, and I heard somebody say, if that man can forgive me, why can't I forgive myself? Why can't I forgive myself? My God, you know, he forgave me, and he didn't have to do that, you know, but he did, you know. And I believe I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous today. There's a little bit of that forgiveness that's in there. You know, the past few years has been a whirlwind for me and my wife. You know, my mother-in-law came down with ovarian cancer. You know, and me and my wife, we were just carting her around and taking her all her places, you know. And I got to watch my wife be a daughter to her mother, man. You want to talk about gifts in Alcoholics Anonymous, man. See, you get another shot if you stay here. You will get a chance. If you stay here and you listen mainly to my old-timers, please, don't disrespect them, you know. You'll get another chance, you know. I love my mother-in-law. My wife got a chance to see my mother-in-law's last breath in her arms. Now, you want to talk about a gift. You know, my higher power is amazing. I don't know about y'all's, you know. 18 months later, my mother came down with lung cancer. You know, and I watched my mother go from a vibrant woman to what that disease do to you, you know. And I remember her looking at me saying that she's glad she got her boy back. You know what I mean? Right after she died, her son came down. And I was diagnosed with lung cancer. But it didn't stop me. It didn't stop me, you know. I'm just glad, in some kind of weird way, I'm glad that my mother doesn't have to see it. Because I see what it does to my dad. You know, I got diagnosed, and me and my wife, we got busy. What do we got to do? And you know what? As of November 29th last year, I'm cancer-free. I'm cancer-free. This, you know what? It ain't on the cancer. It's on my higher power. That's what it's on. And that's what I believe today. You know, I am having an amazing time here this weekend, you know. I love my emotions. I got my emotions back. See, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous gave you. Don't ever mistake crying for a weakness. You know, it gives me, Alcoholics Anonymous gives you emotions back. You know, it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard to leave these two guys here. You want to talk about unconditional love? There it is. These two sitting right here. They take me in their house, me and my wife. I watch their daughter grow. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. You get to see this stuff. You know, you get to see these things. I love this program with all my heart. I love it with every fiber that I have. That's why I say if you're new, please stay around. Please listen, you know. Stop listening to your own head, you know, because it don't work. If it did, why are you here? You know, if it did, why are you here? You know I don't have that much time, so I'm going to say some few things that I relate this whole deal with for me. You know, and you've probably heard them before. Because one of the things I know about Alcoholics Anonymous is everything is regurgitated. You know, so no, there's no real geniuses here. We already had our geniuses, okay? But I want to say this for my friend Mike back there, you know, because he's the history buff, you know. There's a program in Philadelphia, man, you know, at the Constitutional Center, and they talk about the prohibition and different things like that, man. Did you know that in 1840, there was about 8 men who got tired of beating their wives and, you know, spending all their money on booze and stuff like that? And this is in 1840, you know what I mean? And they wanted to know what they can do. And what they did was
they got a hold and they started talking to one another. You know, and they stayed sober for a little bit. But just like these times and those times, there was other stuff going on. There was an organization called the Temperance Movement, you know. And if you wasn't God, about God and everything, you weren't anything, you know. And a lot of these guys got involved in stuff. And that thing didn't last. And most of y'all know about the Oxford Group because that's what came next. But what I want to really say, from 1840, 95 years later, some woman by the name of Henrietta Seiveling was very instrumental in getting that stockbroker and that doctor together. And these two guys did the same thing 95 years later that those eight men did in 1840. Was they sat down and they talked to one another. You know, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what I mean? One alcoholic talking to another is without parallel. That is it. It is that simple. You know, somebody told me we're like a bunch of bananas. Yeah, you want to stick with the bunch because if you leave, you just might get pilled. You know, so. And then I also heard it this way. I also heard we're kind of like jack-o'-lanterns out in the field, in the mud and the dirt and all that stuff, you know. And what happens to us is that someone picks us up, you know, maybe a sponsor or whatever, right? And brings us in, you know what I mean? And what happens is they take us through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, carve us open, get all the gook out and all that stuff. You know what I mean? God puts his light in us and puts us in the window to shine for all the world to see. And that's what it's like. You know, I heard a thing where it says, I sought my soul and couldn't see. I sought my God, he eluded me. I sought my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found all three. Thank you.